welcome to the downstairs panel, or panel A, as we like to call it, panel A plus. And so if I don't have the schedule in front of me, but we have from 4 to 5 and then a 15-minute break.
No, we have
4 to 4:45, then a 15-minute break, and then 5 to 5:45. So the idea is, if you if you haven't done this before, we have a panel going on downstairs, which is titled, I think, Theory and History. I mean, sorry, our panel, what's ours titled? History and Policy? Policy and History, and upstairs they have some weird thing. I don't know. And so if you want to, during the break, you can switch. You can go upstairs or you can stay here as you like. But this is designed as a pretty informal Q&A session. And since some of you submitted, I was given some questions that some of you had written in advance. And by the way, I was asked to moderate the discussion. So what I'll do is I'm going to start by going through some of these written questions, and then we'll just turn it over to the crowd and let you guys ask whatever questions that you like. You can direct your question to an individual member of the panel if you like, or you can just ask anyone to address the panel. And I think we don't have a microphone to pass out to you, so this is being recorded. There's no video recording, but we are doing an audio recording. So I'll repeat the questions just for the sake of you of the recording. But why don't I guess I won't ask these guys to introduce themselves, because these are all men who need no introduction. I'll just go right to the questions. I'm looking at these for the first time in no particular order. But here's a question about WikiLeaks, which is pretty fun. I'm certainly a big fan of WikiLeaks, although I'm not that they are purists in any sense. The question is, what role has WikiLeaks played these last few years? How will WikiLeaks go down in the history books? Anybody have a comment on WikiLeaks? Or on whistleblowers more generally, or transparency and openness that's brought about by the internet age? Okay, next question. Murphy, you want to say something?
I think partly probably why some of us are so hesitant is that we read like antiwar.com, and we know there are so many people who are really up to speed on all the minutiae. But just in general, it's encouraging to see how terrified the U.S. government is of leaks and how much they've thrown the brick at Bradley Manning and so forth, because it shows, in other words, that the only way these systems can last is if they keep people in the dark. And the other thing, too, is it's not just – you got to remember, the people running these regimes are not just afraid of their own people. They also have to systematically lie to the other people, because it's with the leaks that related to Bradley Manning, the people who got mad weren't just general citizens, but also – other leaders who realized that, you know, like in other words, like some ambassador or diplomat from the U.S. would go meet with them and then send a memo to somebody else saying how, yeah, we're totally lying to that guy over there and told him the X, Y, and Z, but really our agenda is this and this in their country. And those people were actually a little bit offended that, you know, they were being clearly lied to and this was being talked about in the memo. So it's sort of interesting just to see how that stuff actually plays out and how much it is totally based on deception, and they have to keep a bunch of secrets. And so it's sort of encouraging, if you don't like what they're doing, that it shows if we can just educate more people and shine light on these things, that they might have to change their practices.
There's a question about Bitcoin, and I guess I'll give this to Murphy, although I hate for him to do all the talking, but he's either written an article or is writing an article on Bitcoin, so I'll ask him to give a brief response. Yeah, it's a Vapor articles, I think.
The next question should be about hairdo or something, so clearly I can't answer that one. I think the issue for Austrians with Bitcoin is it's a electronic commodity currency that the issue is it's mathematically almost impossible to counterfeit it, right? So that's its virtue, and so I think that's the why a lot of libertarian types were interested in it, so that if people started using it en masse, governments wouldn't be able to create more of it. And just by its very nature, that's it would be hard to get into right now. So I think that's the issue. And then as far as Austrians, why are they interested in it? Because there's some relevance between if Bitcoin took off, it has some interesting feedback on the regression theorem and the issue, because Bitcoin had clearly never been tied to a commodity that then became used as a medium of exchange. So I think that's those are the issues. And I do, as Tom mentioned, last year at Mises U, I was like, oh yeah, next week that article's coming out, and it hasn't yet.
He talks about it all the time because he wants to prevent any of us from writing an article on Bitcoin, but he'll never actually write it. Let me turn to one more of the written questions. It's a good question about business cycles prior to the 20th century. So an argument that people sometimes offer is, well, how can you blame the Fed for the business cycle and for financial market instability and so forth? Because we had recessions and we had booms and busts in the 19th century in the U.S. and elsewhere in the world before central banks. So how can you blame the central bank? I'm going to ask Professor Woods to address this question.
All right. So I have a page, tomwoods.com/panics, that has a video on this and has some resources. But I mean, by and large, the argument is that there are consistently various sorts of interventions that you can trace in these various cases. But even if you couldn't – well, I mean, I think it could probably be a problem if you couldn't. But there are additional facts that one might mention. Like, for example – The duration of these recessions is typically less than, let's say, certainly far less than the Great Depression. The so-called Long Depression of the 1870s, which supposedly went on from 1873 to 1879, or in some of the more outlandish reckonings from 1873 to 1896, historians at this point no longer believe this occurred. They believe there was a moderate to sharp recession in 1873, but that actually the 1870s were a pretty good decade in terms of wage rates and growth. The 1880s were even more robust, so that has just disappeared entirely. So in other words, we look at it more closely, particularly when you look at the record of the Fed. Now, you know, probably everybody's had some kind of an issue with George Selgin on one issue or another, but he did do a good paper on the record of the Fed. And what he did was he showed that the most recent data that's uncontaminated, real data about economic performance and output and all the various sorts of variables that are indicators that we'd want to look at, it turns out that recessions have not been fewer and shorter under the period of the Fed. That this is actually a myth, it turns out. So a lot of what we've been led to believe as just sort of common sense that everybody knows, really on second thought is not the case. So you put all this together, and it's not a question of we're stupid because we don't understand that these booms and busts just occur spontaneously for no reason, and then we got the Fed and it evened it all out. The record is not that way. In fact, when you see, for instance, wild output fluctuations in the 19th century, whereas in the 20th century you see these fluctuations are less. This is portrayed as, well, look at the scientific management of the Fed. It's managed to even out output and you don't have all this. But the vast majority of this these cyclical output swings in the 19th century are due to the fact that you're living in a largely agricultural society, and you have harvest failures, and these have a very obvious effect in the statistics. Whereas when you see output fluctuations in the 20th century, this is overwhelmingly due to monetary disturbances. And so what fluctuation we do have in the 20th century, we can attribute much more to bad monetary policy. So there's, in other words, a whole lot that can be said on this. I have a little section on this in Rollback, my latest book. Anybody want to jump in here?
Yeah, George Selgin has a great video on Mises.org if you want to look at this. His paper is called A 100 Years of Failure, and it's been published, but look at the video also. And keep in mind, the fact that we didn't get the Fed until 1913 does not mean there was not government intervention in money. We had the first national bank was in the 1780s. It was called the Bank of North America. It lasted about 2 years and it failed. And then we got the Bank of the United States, which is the second version of central banking. It had a 20-year charter and it created boom and bust and corruption. And so the Congress did not even renew its charter. And then we had the second Bank of the United States to monetize the debt from the War of 1812. So it came back. It did more of the same. It created so much havoc that President Andrew Jackson defunded it in the 1830s. And then also you had periodic suspension of specie payment by the government on the part of private banks. Murray Rothbard writes about this in his book, History of Money and Banking in the United States. You had restrictions on branch banking and all other sorts of government regulations, the Legal Tender Acts and the National Currency Acts that occurred during the Lincoln administration were giant interventions. They put special taxes on competing currencies at the same time. And so when people say, they give you the impression that there was laissez-faire in, you know, free banking in the period before the Fed, that's just untrue. It's just simply untrue. And George Selgin has done a really nice job of this. I think his article's published or to be published in the Journal of Macroeconomics, which is a pretty high-level academic journal.
And then specifically on the question of bank panics, if we look at the period from 1873 up through World War I, in the United States, we do see some of these panics. But in Canada, they basically don't see these panics. And one of the reasons that's been adduced for this is that, believe it or not, Canada had a less regulated system. So oddly enough, less regulation, more stability. And one of the regulations that's pointed to a lot are the unit banking laws that said that you could have only one bank office. You couldn't have interstate branch banking. You couldn't have intrastate branch. You couldn't have branch banking. So obviously each bank is artificially now vulnerable, and because it's naturally it's going to be subject to whatever local swings happen to occur. And this is not how presumably banking would exist on a free market. And so yet when you look around the world, for example, in that period from the 1870s up through World War I, major bank panics, and we're talking about where you have a large number of bank failures with substantial depositor losses, are basically a curiosity around the world. You could count them on one hand. Whereas in the age of central banking, or even just the past 30 years, we have far, far more of these sorts of crises around the world where you have losses in excess of 5 or even 10% of GDP. So it typically happens that the supposed golden age that we're living in is actually much worse than the supposedly terrible age that we were liberated from.
One more footnote. Quick footnote. You don't have to rely on the Austrian economist George Selgin. Bill Clinton's economic advisor, Christina Romer, and Peter Klein's former professor at Berkeley, one of her academic papers showed that the business cycles were more unstable after the Fed than before the Fed. She redid some of the data that previous researchers had used and found the data were faulty, and she redid the data and came up with that conclusion. And that's sort of a deep, dark secret out there, but that is one academic paper that she published.
And one last thing that I would add, I'm not really a historian, but in terms of the theory, right, Austrian business cycle theory is really all about the credit expansion. Now, the reason the Fed is such a big deal today is that it enables this credit expansion. But that doesn't mean that we couldn't have it before the Fed. And we did. I think that Dr. DeLorenzo is absolutely right in that this whole suspension of payments is a huge incentive for banks to go ahead and start expanding credit. That's where I think if you really want to understand banking, one of the great works you need to see is Mary Poppins. Right? There's a great scene where they have this run on the bank. And what do you see all the bank managers doing? Right? Telling the tellers, stop all payments, and they're closing the bank. Now, we know in any other type of contract, this is obviously a breach of contract. I've put the money in here. You have agreed that you'll give it back to me on demand. And now you're just closing the doors and refusing to let me have my money. Right? This is obviously some type of government intervention. It's a privilege granted to banks through the legal system, even before we have anything like central banking.
Yeah. Murray Rothbard said suspension of specie payment is another way of saying license to steal.
And you might generalize from this particular question that many times free market scholars are asked, well, but if, you know, how can you blame the government for all of our problems in the economy. Of course, that isn't the argument whatsoever. The claim is not that in the absence of government intervention, we would live in some kind of a nirvana world, right, where everyone would, you know, we'd all sit around a circle and hold hands and sing kumbaya. No, I mean, you'd still have conflict among people, and we would still have shady business people, and there could be cases of fraud and theft and crime and so forth. It's a comparative institutional question of what set of institutions are best capable of mitigating the problems that are endemic to human, you know, fallible and flawed human beings: centralized authority in the hands of a coercive state, or decentralized institutions for dealing with these kinds of human foibles. Let's have a question on another topic. Yes, sir, in the back.
I guess one of the questions some people might ask is, we would like to see another precious metal standard, preferably a gold standard. But just out of hand, let's say we did impose a gold standard. One of the objections would be that it would create a war for gold, that, you know, nations would start warring over this resource because it became this new international medium of exchange. I know it's a very broad question, but how would you just respond?
So for anybody listening on the recording, the question is, how might a modern gold standard operate if there are conflicts among individuals or countries over possession of the physical gold somehow?
Yeah, wouldn't there just be some huge fight that would break out? All right,
yeah.
The gold standard, everybody's going to grab the gold, let's all invade South Africa sort of thing. I think that's what he means. Okay. Well, yeah, I don't know. What do you guys think would happen in that situation?
Well, I mean, these guys would know, but when we were on the classical gold standard, I never heard anything like that. So, I mean, that's one answer. And then just beyond that, though, I mean, there's nothing magical about, I mean, what's happening if you're on a gold standard, you're saying as a government that anyone who turns in this amount of the currency, we'll give you this much gold. So if you're running, if you print too much and then you're, oh, the gold reserves are going down, so we have a few options, you know, they're advising the leader. One thing we could do is to stop printing so much, or we could just, you know, go out and invade the neighboring country and steal their gold. I mean, that's the thing. But you could also just invade somewhere else and steal their oil and then sell it and then use the money to get gold. You know what I mean? There's no reason you'd have to go fight for gold per se. You could just do anything. So it's not, it'll start wars, just not over gold. This is fine. But you see what I'm saying? I mean, the question, there's no reason you'd go out and attack for gold is what I'm getting at. And I don't think the conflict in general would be an issue.
It does sound like a good script for the next James Bond movie, though.
And of course, to elaborate on Bob, I mean, it isn't the case now under a fiat money regime that gold is not valuable somehow, right? If you're a master criminal and you could go and, you know, break into Fort Knox or, you know, whatever, the New York Fed, and steal all the gold bars, I mean, the fact that we're not on a gold standard now doesn't mean you wouldn't want to do that. I mean, gold has a very high price on the market now. Yes, sir. So the question is, how would things like crime and punishment potentially be dealt with? Yes. I mean, but before I ask someone to answer, I'll just make a comment that in one sense, one way to answer that question is, well, we don't know exactly. Right? Murray Rothbard used to use the following illustration. He said, imagine that the production of shoes had been monopolized by the government for as long as anyone could remember, and you would go to the Central Shoe Bureau to get shoes, and everyone would be assigned a certain number of shoes per year or whatever. And then some radical theoretician comes along and says, what if we privatized the shoe industry? What if we allowed the free market to supply shoes? And of course, all of the establishment thinkers would say, you're crazy. You know, what do you want only rich people to have shoes? And, you know, how could that possibly work? And they might say, well, you tell us, Mr. Theoretician, Mr. Free Market Shoe Guy, you know, what would that market look like? How many shoes would be produced? In what sizes? In what colors? Out of what materials? How many times would people have to buy shoes? What would the shoe prices be? I mean, the correct response of the theoretician would be, I don't know. But, you know, the free market is pretty good at producing pencils and these other things for reasons that we can articulate. We can be fairly confident that if we had a free market for shoes, entrepreneurs would figure out. They would compete against each other. They would compete for customers. They would innovate. They would come up with ways to produce shoes. I can't tell you exactly what the shoe market would look like, but I can be pretty confident that it would be better than a government-controlled shoe market. So I'm not – it's a very good question, but one response to that kind of question could be, look, if we had a free market for criminal detection and deterrence and punishment and the administration of law, you would have entrepreneurs who would be competing against each other to offer those services to consumers. And we don't know exactly what it would look like and how it would work, but we can be pretty confident that entrepreneurs would do a better job at providing law and justice than the state, just as we think they would do a better job at producing shoes than the state. Now, having said that, I know that some of the panelists actually have theorized about how it might work, and maybe they want to comment on that. Tom?
I don't know which panelists we have in mind. I think there's a certain – oh, really? Oh, it doesn't? Okay. All right. Yeah,
let's hear from the bald guy.
I just totally destroyed his joke.
I thought you were going to – Well, you have to keep in mind that the cops are basically crime historians. They show up after the crime has been committed, take a report, then they use the report to justify more government money for the cops. And so you have to compare the alternative, you know, a free market, a free society with the existing system, which is very rotten. And but we don't have to just rely on theorizing, though. There is a history of private law enforcement. There's a book for sale right outside that door called The Enterprise of Law by Bruce Benson. And I would recommend to anybody who's interested in this topic, read the article The Not So Wild Wild West by P.J. Hill and Terry Anderson. It's in a Journal of Libertarian Studies, I think around 1979. It's online. And they wrote about the American frontier in the 19th century when wagon trains were going out there and the mining camps and the cattle industry before there was any government out there. And the wagon trains and the mining camps all had their own constitutions, their own rules. They had private law enforcement. If you stole someone's property, you were kicked off the wagon train and had to go home. And the mining camps were relatively peaceful, much more peaceful than, they say, downtown Montgomery, Alabama on a Saturday night, let's say. And so and it worked pretty well. And then the government did what it always does. It took things over eventually and probably for the worse. So you do have a lot of history that you can look at and see what actually happened. You don't just have to rely on theorizing. And the reason why they call it the Not So Wild Wild West is it wasn't so wild. And you could also look at my article in the Independent Review a couple of years ago on it's called Violence in the American West, Myth Versus Reality, where I make the case that I surveyed this literature by Anderson and Hill and others that it was relatively peaceful, but where the real violence was the government's war on the Plains Indians, in which as many as 60,000 Indians were murdered by the U.S. Army, primarily to make way for the subsidized railroads. And that's where the real violence was in the American West. If you can imagine the U.S. Army sneaking up on Indian villages with Gatling guns and cannon and blasting away when women and children were sleeping there in the teepees, that happened for 25 years in the American West. And it just makes it seem absurd to me that most people think that the West was violent because individuals owned firearms. Yeah, but that's nothing compared to what the U.S. Army did in the American West in the 19th century.
What do you have against armies, Tom?
Did you want to say something? I was just going to add to Tom's point. Larry Schweikart wrote a little article on Western bank robberies, and he basically says that the idea of a Western bank robbery was a myth. He counted more bank robberies in modern-day Dayton, Ohio, than the entire American West over about a 30-year period. This idea that guys in black coats are going to ride into a building in the center of town and rob it in broad daylight and walk out with all the town's money is just an absolute fabrication because, of course, they're not going to get any farther than a few feet before every adult male in the town opens up on them. And it's just not going to happen. And this is in a society in which Tom has pointed out is one pretty far removed from any kind of official law enforcement from a government. It was a society in which the government was mainly concerned with dealing with this genocide in progress.
Last thing, I have a little pamphlet, Chaos Theory, out there, and I got a bunch of references to stuff that deals with all this stuff.
And in my 33 questions about American history, I cite that Schweikart thing, which surprised me too. But also, I think one other thing to note, because this is a hard topic. Like, you can't – there's no glib answer. Like, you should read Bob's Chaos Theory and some of these other sources. But I think we have this view that the system we have now is at least tolerably good, and it would be terrifying to go into the unknown. But yet I'm not sure I'm remembering this correctly, but you think about the number of reported murders, and then how many of those crimes are solved, and then the guilty party is actually found guilty and punished and whatever. What is the percentage of that? Do you guys know? Is it like I've heard like 3%? Like it's shockingly low. It's like a figure that the police kind of hope people don't find out about, because then murderers will just go crazy figuring, well, I got like a 97% chance of getting away with it.
I can give a reference. Morgan Reynolds, who's a fellow traveler of the Austrian school, he was actually the chief economist of the U.S. Department of Labor at one point. He's written some really great books on labor economics, but he also does some work on the economics of crime. And he follows Gary Becker, the Chicago School economist, and he calculates the expected cost of crime, which is basically the probability of being caught and convicted times, you know, the penalty of crime. And he has and you can look. I think he's done a whole bunch of studies for the National Center for Policy Analysis, NCPA. I think it's probably ncpa.org. So you could find his studies there if you look up Morgan Reynolds in crime. And he has such things as if you do this calculation, the expected cost to a criminal of rape was something like 3 days in jail, and so there was effectively, you know, no penalty at the time he did the study of jail, because as Tom implied, there are so few actual catching the criminal and putting him through the process and actually put him in jail for that. And he also saw how murder, I think it was 8 years was the expected penalty for first degree murder, even, and it was much higher in the 50s. But by the time you get to the 80s, as I recall, it was about 8 years was the expected penalty for murder. So depending on the benefits of murdering somebody, I guess 8 years might not be too bad for $50 million if you could steal it from them or something like that.
Yeah, so not just like an annoying coworker, but if the guy's really a jerk, then you know.
Yeah. By the way, in addition to the evidence that's been described already, we can also look at contemporary evidence. I mean, we have private law and private justice today operating in parallel with the state sanction system. We have private arbitration for business contracts, for example. You can hire security guards and have burglar alarms and so on. In fact, there's been a lot of analysis of why measured crime rates in some American cities have been on a secular decline over the last few decades. And of course, the police will be quick to point to, you know, Mayor Bloomberg or whatever will be quick to point to police enforcement as the rule. But a lot of the empirical studies suggest that it's a higher number of burglar alarms and a reduction in price through technological innovation in alarm systems, increase in the number of private security agents and so on. Companies today that are engaged in international transactions are often doing this, you know, as Walter Block would say, in a state of anarchy between nations, such that they rely on maritime law, international law, that is not subject to any monopoly jurisdiction by one particular government agency. So we do have some current evidence for how the private administration of law and justice would work, and it's worth, you know, studying those as well. Let me turn to another one of the written questions, and I'll just sort of summarize it this way. In conventional political discourse, we have, you know, the left-right spectrum, left liberals in the modern sense, right conservatives in the modern sense, all of whom are opposed, you know, advocate certain kinds of restrictions on liberty, sometimes more in the economic sphere, sometimes more in sort of the political or social sphere. what are some particular tactics or arguments that can be effective in arguing against conventional left liberals as opposed to conventional right conservatives? It's a pretty general question, but maybe somebody has some comment on how to approach opponents of the free society who come from different kinds of perspectives.
I'd say what worked for me when I first started college, I was a pretty standard conservative Republican, would have thought myself as being pretty far on the right. But I believed in free markets and property rights. And then it was actually reading Friedman who convinced me that, in fact, if you really believe in property rights, you have to believe in all the property rights that could possibly happen, right? Which means all kinds of other personal freedoms. So at first I was very disturbed by the idea of, oh, making prostitution legal. Kind of rubbed me the wrong way. I'm a very conservative right-wing person. But then I realized, well, if somebody does own their body and own their money, then the possibility of having this type of exchange is something I have to accept as long as I believe that they have a right to that. So coming from the right, I think it's often said that conservatives are a philosophy class away from being libertarian, while liberals are an economics class away from being libertarian. And at least for me, that was true coming from the right. Thinking more consistently pushed me in that direction.
Okay. Yeah. Now, I talk to a lot of people in the conservative area because that's where I kind of come from, too. And I don't want people to think that all libertarians think about is prostitution, but it is a handy example. St. Thomas Aquinas has a
nuclear weapons is mostly what
St. Thomas Aquinas has a part of the Summa Theologiae called the Treatise on Law. That's how it's referred to anyway. A certain section of it, and he considers the question whether all vices should be crimes, and he answers in the negative. And he says that the vices that should be crimes are, by and large, vices that involve harm committed against people. And so these are kinds of things that we think about, murder and theft and things of that sort. And he was willing to consider that prostitution could be tolerated because in trying to stamp it out, you would probably bring about greater moral evils than you would save people from, and that when you call something the world's oldest profession, well, that means it's been able to get around your restrictions for quite some time. So the way a normal society deals with this, and it's totally unconservative to think, well, some law will just stamp out a moral foible that has existed since the beginning of time. That's the way a left progressive thinks. That's not how a conservative is supposed to think. A conservative is supposed to think, well, in our society, probably what will happen is that this particular vice will tend to be confined to the bad part of town. And it's sort of like the same neocon mentality that says, let's eliminate evil around the world. No conservative is supposed to think this way. This is an absurd way to think. So then the other way I would approach them is I would say if conservatives look around at society and they say, my gosh, it's in this terrible moral condition and we just need more state power to stamp out all these problems. Number one, I think when society is in a terminal moral condition, by that point it's too late for any of these remedies. I mean, these sorts of things need to happen spontaneously through voluntary institutions and families and whatever. But secondly, I would say, what is the single biggest institution in propagandizing the youth? It's the educational system. That's done more than anything to get kids thinking like left progressive robots is that system. And so I would say it is vastly more likely that you would have a society of your – at least a neighborhood, a society to your liking – if you had a society where there was no official coercive channel by which left progressives could impose their worldview on you and your kids. And they need the state apparatus to do that. And they need the educational apparatus, which is just an extension of that, to do that. If they didn't have that, it would be a lot easier to raise your kids and to live in a society where you could be happy. And then people who live in Greenwich Village could have their society and they'd be happy. And no, they wouldn't share your views. But again, there's no way you're going to stamp out every single vice in the world. You shouldn't think that way as a conservative. You should think you're living in a fallen world. And if I can live tolerably, then I'm content with that.
Quickly, we only have 2 minutes left. Okay. How about a comment on reaching out to people on the left?
I saw a great Facebook meme thing after the Colorado or you know what happened, and so all these people were for gun control. And there was a poster of this clearly left liberal college activist girl, and it said thinks guns should be banned, and then down here it said smokes weed. And so, you know, clearly, like, so telling, like, a lot of people know banning drugs doesn't do anything, and they can go on and on about how that's silly and all these problems. You're not going to stamp it out, plus all these other things. So I think that's one way you appeal. I'll hint to you guys. What I would say, though, is I think rhetorically, so you don't sound like a jerk and you sound sincere, you should appeal to the group you came from. So Tom and I both used to be, and I guess Luke's ridiculous, obnoxious right-wing conservatives. So we talk to them and say, guys, how can these people in power who you know are evil when it comes to your health care and raising taxes on business are noble and care about people in the Middle East? Are you kidding me? And, you know, they go give them $500 billion for the defense budget and they'll spend that wisely. But, you know, don't let them hit my Medicare. Oh, my gosh. So that just doesn't make any sense. But if you're coming from the left and you're a libertarian now, you need to be the ones that are reaching out, because we don't really even know how to talk to them because our worldviews have been so different. And we'll sound like we're just trying to trick them.
Yeah, I think one of the things that struck me about Walter Block's talk yesterday, he mentioned his conversation with Milton Friedman where he says, well, Milton Friedman is basically just a Rhodes socialist. Okay, well, it helps to change your to get people to evaluate their own vocabulary by kind of throwing these terms at them. You want to do that, as Bob said, without trying to come across as snarky and offensive and obnoxious. But if you can point out that what people are really doing is they're behaving like socialists, and most people, especially on the right, think, well, that's a bad thing. I can't be a socialist, so maybe I should reevaluate my position. If you can't do anything else than get people to use accurate terms to describe their own views, then that's a step in the right direction, I think.
Before we close a minute, I would say everybody believes in personal liberty in some small area. Okay, maybe not Joe Lieberman, but almost everybody would accept, you know, liberty in some area. You find that area, and then you reason by analogy and say, well, why do you think it's okay for people to make free choices in this small area, and why would the same arguments not apply to this adjacent area and this adjacent area and so forth? But it's time for the 15-minute break when you can get a drink, use the bathroom, you can switch panels if you want, or you can stay here for another 45 minutes with us. So thank you. All right, it's time to start round two of the faculty panels. Welcome to the panel on policy and history, or as we like to call it, the fun panel. We welcome those of you who came from upstairs, the boring panel. We're going to do it just with audience Q&A. We've already run through the written questions that we had received in advance, and so we're just going to turn it over to you guys. We don't have a microphone to pass around, so if you would please state your question as loudly as you can, and for the benefit of the recording, I'll try to summarize your question into the microphone. And if you want a specific person to if you want to address a specific panelist, please do so, or you can throw it open to any of the panelists, and anyone can answer except for Bob Murphy. Yes, sir, in the back. Outlefting the left or outriding the right in your arguments. I'm not sure I know exactly what that means, but okay, I'm going to.
Yeah, no, this is where you really screw with people, okay? Because this is where, you know, you say to the conservatives are there, we believe in private property and the free market. But without realizing it, I mean, you know, most people don't think about the Fed, or they don't think about, you know, they think they're being cheeky when they say, I'm against the income tax and I want to replace it with a sales tax. They're probably going to put me away if they ever find me for holding this view. And then you come along and say, well, wait a minute. Look, this thing that you despise, you think this institution that you think is wrecking your kids and screwing up their brains and racking up all this debt, and they're full of liars and scoundrels, this thing is not going to be tamed unless you radically – unless you take resources from it. You don't you shouldn't be thinking in terms of, well, gee, maybe if we'll just take the resources in a different way. You know, I mean, come on, man. So that's outrighting them or saying, well, I thought you believed in the free market. But so let's see. So you want a monopoly banking – like a cartel banking system with monopoly privileges shot through and implicit and explicit bailout guarantees? Through the whole thing, that strikes you as free market? I thought you were for the free market. And well, I am. I mean, I've never, like, right, like, they walk away, my gosh, right? That's outrighting the right. Or even telling them that war is really just another government central planning program. What? No, it's not. It's awesome. Or out-lefting the left would be, you know, just saying that I don't want to politicize this, but naturally people are talking about Obama. So you say, well, you know, look, Obama's terrible on civil liberties or on the drug war or on this or that or the other thing. I can't possibly support Obama because I believe in civil liberties. I can't support Obama because I'm against giving money to fat cats. I'm against Obama because I believe in equality. I'm against Obama because I'm anti-war. That is just going to screw with people. That's what it means to out left the left and outright the right.
And so that's how Tom talks at home. Would you like to? Do you want to watch a movie, honey? Yeah. I just outwoodsed Woods. Let me just follow up on that. Something for what's really interesting is because we know there's in the U.S. for whatever reason, I'm still trying to diagnose it. But one of the strongest groups supporting U.S. military is the evangelical churches, like and so out there I've tried to like out Christian the Christians, if you will, in the same respects. Let me just very briefly talk about that. The strategy there or the approach I found with people is they're really gung ho in like the idea that the U.S. military could be in the wrong and something is inconceivable. But yet, you know, their whole worldview, you say, no, but man has fallen, right? And so you can't trust this man-made institution. You know, you get the moral authority and the proper rules and ways of living come from the Lord and so forth. And that's actually something that a lot of, like, they instantly back right down. And they're like, well, yeah, I know that. That's true. And the thing here, it sounds like we're trying to say, like, how to trick people. And I don't mean it to come off like that, but it really is for certain people. If you just say things in a certain way to come at it, because they're so amped up. They think they know what you believe. I can't tell you. When Bush was in office and we were writing articles about that, I got so many emails saying, yeah, you just love Nancy Pelosi, don't you? And I said, well, she's mildly attractive. That it was such a joke. And then the other, of course, now that Obama's in there, I get all these emails talking about how I love Dick Cheney and, you know, I wish John McCain would have won, huh? You know, and it's, which is just absurd. So again, these people, they assume, and you got to try to like shut that down right away and make them think you're coming from a different angle. And if you're all of a sudden like, oh, I hadn't thought of that, that kind of, I don't know, opens them up to listen.
Well, no, another thing, something that I've done, and who knows how effective it might ever be, but you know, most conservatives are always bragging about what constitutionalists they are. The nutcase Mark Levin even wrote a whole book on constitutionalism, and now as soon as Obama came in office, these guys all became very libertarian sounding, and they started writing books about the Constitution. But when Bush was in office, their mantra was 9/11 changed everything, which meant the hell with the Constitution. Whether it's Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, Mark Levin, the whole crowd of them, but they do still claim, so they're phonies when they talk about it, but they still always claim to be devotees of the American founding fathers and their ideas. But the American founding fathers were all secessionists. They seceded from the British Empire. They violently seceded from the British Empire. Thomas Jefferson, to the day he died, he was writing letters in the 1820s to friends saying he thought that America would probably be broken up into seven or so different republics, and he said, they will all be our children, and we wish them well. He didn't do what Abe Lincoln did and said, we will invade your your state and bomb your cities into a smoldering ruin. He said, God bless you and we will wish you well. And so I think it's important to point out that these people are phonies when they talk about constitutionalism. And another big point about this is with Mark Levin, for example, and he was a big proponent of every attack on civil liberties that the Bush administration perpetrated. And then when Obama's in, he writes a book on constitutionalism. And so like the talk I'm going to give at our 30th anniversary conference in Callaway Gardens in October is the myth of the pro-war constitutionalist. And keeping in mind of people like Levin, because if you listen to Bob Higgs's talks, you know that war is inherently incompatible with the protection of civil liberties and many other liberties as well. And so I think we can destroy the credibility of some of the neocons anyway who parade about as constitutionalists by pointing out that they're just wrong about history and also they're phony about it.
Let me just say one last thing. Earlier this year, the Mises Institute sponsored an event at Furman University in South Carolina on – it was called War, Big Government's Best Friend. And that's also meant to screw with people like this. War, Big Government's Best Friend. And Tom was there and Bob Higgs was there and I was there. And I gave a talk that then when it was uploaded to YouTube, I basically named it after the conference. And I'm very happy with how that came out. I basically systematically went through how I went from being one of these rah-rah Operation Desert Storm hat and T-shirt guy to being the guy I am now. And like what realizations hit me. And so but also it's a historical and, you know, a political overview of this topic. And so it's just called War, Big Government's Best Friend on YouTube.
By the way, you guys have said almost nothing about outlefting the left because we have a group of, I guess, former neocon, arch conservative types. I wouldn't say I'm exactly from the left, but I did go to Berkeley. So let me address the other side a little bit. A lot of left progressive rhetoric over several decades has been, or left progressive ideas have been couched in somewhat libertarian rhetoric. You know, if you bring up with people on the left issues about abortion, birth control, gay marriage, they often speak about, you know, their slogans are, well, you know, get the government out of my bedroom, or the government has no business in my womb. Right. Or if it's about drugs, maybe the government shouldn't tell me what substances I can put into my body. If you have someone who starts from that perspective, then, you know, you can talk about, well, why should the government be able to be in your, you know, in your wallet? If you don't want the government in your bedroom, what about the government in your office or in your bank account and so forth? Again, sort of finding areas of common ground and pushing a little bit can often be a very useful strategy. Next question. Yes, please. I'll start with a brief remark on that. The question was about if we didn't have the Food and Drug Administration supervising the process of drug development and so forth, if we didn't have intellectual property rights, that so-called intellectual property rights, patents and so forth for things like drug discovery, what would be the incentive of pharmaceutical companies to make the huge investments that are necessary to produce modern, you know, pharmacological products? I mean, one way to answer that question is to kind of flip it around and say, well, why do you think that whoever's asking you the question, why would you think that the amount of money spent on research and development for drugs today under a fairly strong intellectual property regime is the right amount? Right. Maybe we have overinvestment in drugs, in drug discovery, relative to what would obtain on the free market. And of course, we can talk about how innovation might be encouraged and protected in the absence of intellectual property laws. But I think we need to begin by saying, well, we don't really know. You know, it's not the case that more is necessarily better. Whenever I talk about intellectual property in my classes, almost every time, you know, I get one student who raises his hand and says, yeah, but I'm in a band. And, you know, we put our music, we do you know, we put our music out there on the web, and if anybody could just copy our music, we couldn't make any money being musicians, and that's wrong. You know, to which I politely reply, you know, well, your band stinks, right? Or, you know, why is it the case that more bands is necessarily better? We want, you know, sort of economic efficiency suggests a pattern of investment in being a band member or drug discovery that's consistent with the wishes of consumers to purchase those products and so forth. Yes, of course, if you subsidize an activity, you're likely to get more of that activity. But that doesn't indicate that it's a good thing to have that more of that activity.
Yeah, right. I mean, this is not really an area of mine at all, but
it, nonetheless, you have something to say about it.
Of course. Well, you know, I went to Harvard. That's what we do. But but it really is true that, of course, you are implicitly saying that obviously any subsidy for anything will yield you more of that thing. So this type of argument would then justify every subsidy that exists. But the other thing that I would recommend is there's a book out there. I think we still carry this book called Against Intellectual Monopoly. It's not the Kinsella book. It's a different book that really looks at this from a consequentialist point of view, that actually shows that although we sort of casually assume that, well, in the absence of these intellectual property protections, none of these things would ever get done because there's no incentive to do it and all that. It's actually not true. It's sort of like the public good arguments for, well, if it weren't for government funding, there'd be no science, because science doesn't immediately turn a profit, and one particular firm can't capture all the benefits of a discovery because its competitors will pick it up. And yet the fact is there has been a lot of science in the free market, and there was a lot of it before there was any government funding of it. So anyway, so I recommend that that book, Against Intellectual Monopoly, for specific examples.
It's not really clear that even patents lead to more research, because what happens when you get a patent? You get a 20-year monopoly. Well, that means whatever the area was, like some sort of area of cancer research, nobody else has any incentive to spend any money on it because it's a monopoly and it's illegal to compete. And so in a free market, you might have 50 companies competing to come up with a new cancer drug. But if you have the monopoly on that for 20 years, why would they bother? And so it's not at all clear that even the existence of patents leads to more research. It leads to politicized research, because it's a political game to a large extent. And also, what the existence of the FDA is all a part of something that Charles Murray wrote about in his book In Pursuit, in that he makes a point in several chapters that, you know, government takes over the schools. People respond by saying, I don't need to educate my own kids very much. Government takes over welfare. I don't need to take care of the poor people in my neighborhood very much. Government does it. Government takes over old age insurance. I don't need to take care of my own parents or grandparents. Government will take care of them. The FDA will make sure my drugs are safe. I don't need to worry about my health. I can get fat. I can smoke. I can drink like an alcoholic. And then when I get sick, I'll take the super drug. And that's sort of the attitude that millions of Americans have taken. And that's why, you know, today a lot of people are waking up to this and are trying to drink raw milk and all sorts of things, taking care of their own health. And the government is cracking down on them a lot. I just met somebody last 2 weeks ago. I gave a talk at a Libertarian Party group in Palm Beach, Florida, where there was some guy delivering raw milk, and the government found out about it, and they destroyed $40,000 worth of his supply of raw milk that he's trying to sell people. So the point is, it sort of crowds out individual efforts to watch out for your own health if you think you can rely on the super drug. And that's and you also should understand something about drug lag. It's a little bit better now, but the phenomenon of the FDA is that the bureaucrats there know that it's very, very bad PR if they let a drug on the market that turns out to be really dangerous and kills somebody. And so they might take 15, 16, or 17 years of tests before they allow it on the market. And in the meantime, that drug might be, a heart drug that could save lives from preventing second heart attacks or something like that. And so you have maybe tens of thousands of people who die of second heart attacks because that drug is not available. And that has happened a lot. And the French version of the FDA, by the way, the whole French blood supply was tainted with the HIV virus about 20 years ago. So you have to compare the reality of the having an FDA with the alternative that is out there. They're not perfect by any means.
The comment that we made, I think, in the first session about Rothbard's example of the shoes, we don't really know what if we've never had a free market in shoes, we don't know what a free market in shoes would quite look like. And I think that if you do away with certain intellectual property laws, you have the same kind of issue. We don't know what kind of contracts might exist between drug companies and vendors to provide an exclusive channel for their products. If you want a new drug first comes out and it's guaranteed to be effective by this particular vendor network, that might be one of the institutional arrangements that comes out of a free market. So just as you see cell phone providers that get first crack at the new iPhone or some other new technology, you might also see vendor networks in medical practice that get first crack at new pharmaceuticals and maybe also accompany that with some kind of warranty or guarantee of effectiveness and safety.
By the way, in the U.S., like other countries, there's a lot of course, federal government funding for scientific research going through the National Science Foundation, the National Institutes of Health, and so on. Earlier this year, some Republican congressmen, real hardcore fiscal conservatives, proposed making, very small cuts to the amount of government funding for scientific research. Specifically, a very, very small percentage of National Science Foundation money goes to social – they call it behavior on social science, which includes economics, political science, psychology, and so on, certain kinds of psychology. And so they the proposal was to eliminate the part that goes to political science. I mean, I don't have the percentage, but it's a teeny, teeny fraction of the overall NSF budget, token measure by these Republicans, I guess, to tell their constituents that they're cutting out the fat from, academics living high off the hog. The organized political science community has gone absolutely bananas over this. I've gotten a flood of emails. I'm not a political scientist, but somehow I'm getting emails, from different professors about, writing your congressman, and we're going to organize resistance and boycott, and how horrible this is that they're cutting our funding. Look at these examples of path-breaking research that has been produced by, scholars funded by the National Science Foundation. And it struck me that there's been no attempt whatsoever to justify any kind of overall public benefit from funding for government funding of political science research. I mean, we have no idea what kind of political science research would be produced in a free society. And there's no way to measure the benefits that are produced by this particular kind of funding. But I've pointed out in some of my discussions with these people, there are some studies of the effect of government funding of science in the hard sciences. And one of the main findings is that the primary effect of government spending on scientific research is to increase the wages of scientific researchers. Right? So any way you try to measure benefit to the public or advance of knowledge and so forth, the return on investment is pathetically small. The main beneficiaries of government subsidy for science is scientists. Yes, sir, in the back. So the question is, in the absence of intellectual property laws, could some inventors protect their innovations by writing contracts with those to whom they sell the innovations, maybe non-disclosure agreements, non-compete agreements? I mean, I think the answer is yes. That's one of the ways that they would do it. Yeah. But, and of course, the point is that wouldn't be any kind of a violation of anyone's rights. Nor would that have the kind of negative consequences that we've been talking about earlier. Parties would be free to negotiate contractual means to protect property, as they see fit.
There is a little bit of a subtlety on that kind of issue that I think I'm just repeating what Stefan Kinsella's position is. If you think about it, it's easier to think about like a book or something. So you could say, oh, what if you publish a book and the publisher says as a condition of you buying this novel that's in printed form at the store, you're agreeing you're not going to take the same story and put your name on it and sell it as your book. You could do that, have a contract with 50 million people who buy the book. But then if Tom does that and he agrees, so he would be breaking the contract if he did. But if that book's at his house lying on the table, and I go over there and I flip through it, and then I go and write the same story up and put my name on it, that publisher has nothing on me, and they would be violating my property rights if they said I can't use my Microsoft publishing platform to publish that and say, hey, that's my story. So, I mean, there is that little bit of a subtlety. So things like with drugs or whatever, if you could reverse engineer it, it would be hard for some company in the U.S. to stop some company in Africa from doing it if they could show, no, we didn't, you know, some other guy stole from you, but we didn't, you know, and we're making millions of dollars now, and you can, that guy down there is a, you know, he bought your pill and then gave it to us, and you can take his donkey if you want, go ahead. But, you know what I mean? So technically that link would have been broken.
Let's go in the very back, red shirt in the back. So the question is about outlefting the left on climate change. Murphy?
Okay. So a few things. So one way is to you can bring up obvious stuff like saying, look at government ownership of roads is terrible in terms of climate change. If you're worried about that, because you know all these people in rush hour traffic that just sit there, you know, crawling forward, spewing all this stuff in the atmosphere. If you had private roads where, you know, you had to pay a certain amount, you know, more at 8 o'clock in the morning than you would at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, traffic would flow much more smoothly. And so you wouldn't have all these traffic jams. So there's, you know, things like that you could point to. The U.S. military is a huge emitter of greenhouse gases. So, you know, for no other reason, you want to minimize that kind of stuff. So you could do things like that. And then also just in general with, like, leftists who know that on many issues, oh, I don't trust big corporations, they're in bed with the government and that kind of stuff. You'd say, well, so why would you give the government more power? You think that's going to solve it? You know, and so that's one issue. Just one other thing that switched to the analogy, when people are worried about, you know, they want to have national health care or whatever, and you say, okay, so you want President Palin in charge of your health care? You know, and so it's like, you know, every 8 years it'll be awful, but then when we have our guy in there, it'll be great. So I try to do stuff depending on how radical the person is. And yeah, I don't think it's going to work. I have never convinced someone using that strategy. They're just like, well, this is just so important, we're going to have to throw a Hail Mary and hope this is the one time the government doesn't screw us. But,
well, you know, outlefting the left on climate change, the gurus of the environmental movement are basically communists. I mean, I call them watermelons. They're green on the outside, red on the inside. You know, your average college student who calls himself an environmentalist is sort of a happy-go-lucky advocate of recycling and all. But you know, Barry Commoner and all these old geezers who wrote all the tomes, Paul Ehrlich, they're real hardcore communists. And they always have seen this as an entree to central planning and worldwide income redistribution. And it's just, you know, just part of the decades-long horror stories they've told about capitalism and the evils of capitalism. You know, it started a long time ago. Read the late Robert Heilbronner. Hold your applause, please, when I use the word late for the Heilbronner. But he wrote a book around the time of the collapse of communism in 1990. He wrote an article called After Communism in the New Yorker magazine. Heilbronner was a socialist economist his whole life. He became a millionaire on a book called The Worldly Philosophers. It should have been The Left-Wing Worldly Philosophers, but it sold a lot of books. But he wrote this article, and in the article he said Mises was right about socialism. So it was a big mea culpa about, you know, okay, you were right about capitalism, I was wrong. But then the whole second half of the article is instructions to the left of how to go about promoting central planning and socialism in the future, and it was environmentalism. Let's use environmentalism as an excuse to win after all, even though history in the 20th century has proven socialism to be an utter failure. So these people never give up. And so that's why when they had their summit in Rio de Janeiro about a month ago, I wrote an article on lourockwell.com called The Watermelon Summit, and I quoted Heilbronner. And so I'm not sure you'd want to outright outleft the left on that. That means you'd be a bigger commie than Robert Heilbronner. But another point I would make is that there's a long list of literature on free market environmentalism that emphasizes property rights as a way of solving all kinds of environmental problems. Murray Rothbard has a famous article, at least among us anyway, on property rights and air pollution. But the guys at Montana State what are they called now? They used to be called PERC, still PERC, P-E-R-C. Go to PERC.org. There's gigantic literature on the role of property rights in solving all kinds of environmental problems. And if you run across people who are honest and actually genuinely concerned about conservation, they'll listen to you. But if you run across a real watermelon, they won't pay any attention to that because that's not what they're interested in. Property rights is always the enemy in terms if you're a hardcore socialist ideologue like Paul Ehrlich or Barry Commoner or one of these characters.
One of the ways to approach this is just to say, really, you're such an elitist that you want Western developed countries to tell people in poor developing countries how they should live and condemn them to a death of malaria and sacrifice tens of millions of their children to malaria because you don't think they ought to use DDT. You're really that much of an elitist that you don't think that people in those countries themselves ought to be able to decide whether or not they use these chemicals or whether they decide they want to pursue some particular environmental policy that the West thinks is appropriate. So I think perhaps returning the decision-making power over these things to the nations that are involved and to the individual tribes and families that are having to watch their children die of malaria, that might be fairly effective as an approach. It's absolutely ignoring the massive death toll that the elitist Western environmentalists have imposed on these nations.
Yeah, as a footnote to that, by the way, the environmental movement has always been in favor of massive foreign aid because they want to stop economic development in a third world, and they realize that that would result in massive starvation and death. And so that's why they are also big advocates of foreign aid. They say, don't get wealthy like us. We will send you welfare, has always been their position.
Really fast. I thought of two more examples specifically for what you're talking about. One issue, and it actually did happen, so it's got the added virtue. Most of what we talk about is theoretical stuff that might someday happen. This actually did happen. On ethanol, the environmentalist left used to be big on subsidies for ethanol, to wean us from our addiction to fossil fuel and that kind of stuff. But then when people saw how much it was driving up corn prices, they flipped, and a lot of the leftist environmentalists now they don't like ethanol support because they say it's taking food from people's bellies and putting it in our automobiles. Like that's the way. So that's one issue. The other is in terms of dealing with carbon emissions. For a while, the leftist environmentalists weren't sure, do we want to go for a carbon tax or cap and trade? But then when it became clear that Goldman Sachs would be the ones running these emission credits and they would get a lot of the environmentalists then went hardcore for a carbon tax. So they didn't become free market environmentalists, but the point is they weren't stupid and they could see, wait a minute, if this is going to help Goldman Sachs, maybe we're not for it.
You can also always take a question like that and flip it on its head by challenging the assumptions, looking at the history as has been pointed out. I mean, if you care about the environment, the best thing ever to happen to the environment is capitalism, right? I mean, we can look at the historical record. We can look at the contemporary record in the non-capitalist world. I mean, of course, environmental degradation in the Soviet bloc countries is, orders of magnitude worse than anything that was experienced in Western societies, just as, people are brought up on these historical myths. It's just like the Industrial Revolution. It's these evil historians, Tom Woods. People were taught in school that the Industrial Revolution, was harmful to women and children and so forth, when the historical evidence suggests that capitalism was the best thing ever to happen to poor, to reducing rural poverty, to the poor rural poverty and so on. You look at another – I forgot who's the author of that book, The Myth of the Ecological Indian. A great book. It's called – It's a great book by a historian on
pollution and trash in pre-capitalist societies. And most of you are too young, but the old guys here remember a very famous commercial when I was a kid of a Native American Indian paddling his canoe down a river that must have been in Detroit or something, you know, with rotten tires and trash. And there's a tear streaming down his cheek as he looks around at, you know, his natural environment being destroyed by these Westerners. The truth is precisely the reverse, that the Native Americans created huge amounts of trash. They hunted many animal species to extinction. They just had a different kind of trash. They didn't have industrial waste, but they had animal waste and bones and all of their leftover products and so forth. But this idea that outside of capitalism, we would have this sort of happy green Nirvana world isn't consistent with anything we know about any historical knowledge that we have.
I skipped. Where'd you go? Okay, right there. In black T-shirt.
Yes.
The one of you in the Ron Paul T-shirt. Everybody starts talking.
Yeah, I wanted to know, kind of going back to history. Is there any good history resources talking about booms and busts, either in American countries and/or going back to something like ancient Rome or something like that?
The question is: good historical literature on booms and busts outside of the U.S. and Europe, or going way back into ancient history. I don't know if you can find a video on that on tomwoods.com, but I'm guessing that's where I would start.
Yeah, that's I wonder if you would really say that there was a business cycle in the ancient world. I'm not sure that you would say that. You could have some fluctuations. You know, you could have a sector that was depressed, but I'm not sure you would really have a business cycle.
You can certainly – any of the standard histories can talk about inflation, right? When there were large inflows of specie in the ancient world. I mean, remember, it was the late medieval economists, the scholastics of the 15th, 16th century, who first started thinking systematically about monetary economics, the relationship between the money supply and prices. And the reason is because they were living through an age of what at that time was unprecedented price inflation. And what's going on, of course, it's all the import of specie from the new world to the old was making prices rise. So, I mean, that isn't a business cycle, of course, in the way that we would think of it now. But there's, you know, the relationship between money and prices is very well established in ancient, you know, certainly in older texts. Probably there's things, you know, from Roman times about inflation during the Roman era.
Yeah, but I don't know the other part of the question about outside of the West. Yeah, I don't know what the literature would be. So just chalk that up for one to ask David Gordon.
Yes, right there in the back, please.
Yeah.
Okay, so the question is about current monetary policy debates. One refers to the so-called dual mandate by which the Fed is statutorily required or told to, you know, pursue two objectives. One is the sort of conventional one of price stability, but also the Fed is now charged with maintaining full employment. Sort of the mainstream interpretation of this is that, well, there's a trade-off. You know, the Fed should be tight to keep prices stable. I mean, of course, we would say that the whole premise of that claim is based on a misunderstanding of what a central bank does. But the conventional version is that, you know, tight monetary policy is consistent with price stability, but you need loose expansionary monetary policy, monetary stimulus when the economy is in recession to increase, to reduce the unemployment rate. There's now a debate. Some of the legislative proposals on the table now include eliminating the dual mandate or charging the Fed with focusing only on keeping prices stable and not asking the Fed to try to do anything about unemployment. Comments?
Yeah. Okay. Just a few things. So on the issue of the dual mandate, what is funny, it's interesting to watch, is that the people who want the market monetarists, but also like guys like Paul Krugman and others, they do have a point insofar as the Fed's own projections to show they think price inflation is going to be below their target
and that unemployment is going to be above their target for like the next 3 years. And then Bernanke says, we have plenty of ammunition, and if we ever were called upon to use it, we would, you know, or if we ever thought the economy needed our help. And so they're kind of going nuts saying, your own projections show that you're having more unemployment and lower inflation, so why wouldn't you? You know, what are you waiting for? And so that's, I mean, it is kind of funny just to see them squirming because, you know, and these academics, it's hilarious because they're like looking at Bernanke's own papers from when he was an academic saying, Ben, did you read your paper? You know, and then they're trying to see them squirming and trying to understand the mystery of it's almost like Bernanke's lying to us. It doesn't make any sense, you know, and it's almost like he's taking his orders from someone else. I can't remember what model is he using? Like that's it's just kind of funny to watch that. And so, There is that issue. And then the fiscal monetary, I don't know if this is what you're talking about, but the issue there is like Congress could do, or the Bernanke will say, well, we don't want to do any more right now. We want to like leave this up to the Congress. And then again, these market monetarist guys are going nuts saying, because you, Ben, aren't printing enough, therefore they think they might have to run a bigger deficit and you wouldn't have to do. So, I mean, to me, it just shows how crazy that whole system is and that, if you know, they are basically Keynesian in their approach, and that these fine distinctions between, no, I'm really a free market guy, I just think that there's a role for monetary. I mean, that doesn't mean they're wrong. It could be the Keynesians are right, but the point is they don't think the Keynesians are right on fiscal stuff, and yet you see how closely those things are related.
I was about to say the same thing.
Okay.
Okay. Yes, please.
Well, I would just say that actually most historians have not necessarily claimed that the New Deal fixed things. In my 33 Questions book, I cite numerous ones. I cite our friend Tom Doris Kearns Goodwin. She says, by the way, she's not our friend. She's a terrible, terrible human being. Yeah, yeah. But she says that, you know, after all the different things that were tried, it fell short. It did not cure the Depression. And I quote numerous other people. Now, some of them come along and say, but World War II fixed it or whatever. Well, that's not a conspiracy. That's just because they don't understand, you know, economics or something, which is not a recent problem with historians. But the other thing is, okay, so some of them say, as I say, at least some of them will admit this. But then they'll turn around and say, but he gave the country hope. Like that was, at least he did that. He gave the country hope. That's usually what they say. They don't usually. Now, on the other hand, your high school teacher might say Franklin Roosevelt turned things around. But normally a professional historian who's publishing a serious work will either say it just didn't work out, or some of them will take a more subtle approach and will say, look, growth figures, economic growth figures are actually fairly robust after 1933. So you have to admit things started to turn around. Those people will usually not talk about the fact that unemployment was still very high and that this was the longest downturn ever. But I don't think you're in this impossible situation of having to argue that it's a conspiracy of all the historians to get together, because they're not really taking this crude, simplistic view after all.
Well, you can also point out that the government's own statistics show that the unemployment rate in 1940 was in the 15% range, whereas in 1929 it was 2.9%. So if you're debating one of your classmates over that, ask them, you know, how could the New Deal have ended the Great Depression if unemployment was still five times higher than it was at the beginning of the Great Depression? And, you know, you could just rely on plain facts like that. In fact, as Tom said, you know, not all the historians make this ridiculous claim, although I have heard Newt Gingrich make that claim, that FDR ended the Great Depression. But I was in the used bookstore today next to an Amsterdam cafe, a restaurant in town, and I bought a book called The NRA Was a Failure, and that was the National Recovery Act, and it's written by a liberal historian like in the 1960s. I haven't even read it yet, but I caught my eye. The NRA was a failure. So there are liberal historians who are honest and look at the fact that the New Deal didn't end the Great Depression. In fact, our research shows it made it actually worse, and you don't have to rely on Mises' theory. There's been a lot of economic history and documentation of that that shows it actually made it worse and longer lasting. I would recommend the book Out of Work by Richard Vedder and Lowell Galloway.
And then finally, there's this great quotation from the Treasury Secretary in 1939. Henry Morgenthau said, "We've spent and spent and spent and spent, and we've created this huge debt and had all these problems, and yet unemployment is practically almost 20%. It has not worked." Now, who is who are you going to believe in this case? In a case like this, right? If people who are criticizing you, you say, "Well, look, I guess I think the Treasury Secretary at the time, looking at all the data and saying this thing hasn't worked, has a little bit more credibility than you, some guy today." That would be the way I would put it.
Well, we're almost out of time. I'm going to take the moderator's privilege of adding a comment to that and generalizing it a little bit. I actually took your question to be more not so much about the specifics of the Depression case, but more generally, you know, if you believe that what you learned in your high school history textbook is the conventional wisdom is not correct, you suspect it somehow, or you believe that there are private interests that have some effect on government policy, doesn't that make you a crazy person, right? Doesn't that make you a conspiracy nut? It's important, I think, to refute that kind of allegation on a couple of grounds, right? First of all, in claiming that the government has made things worse in these different cases we've been talking about, in claiming that, you know, things that are in your history textbooks might be wrong, we aren't arguing that there's this sort of secret shadowy cabal, you know, the Illuminati are somehow pulling all the strings and getting themselves rich and writing the history books. And, I mean, they might be, but we're not necessarily saying that. We're making much more reasonable arguments, right? We aren't claiming, of course, that, you know, Franklin Roosevelt or Barack Obama or Doris Kearns Goodwin or whatever, that these are somehow, you know, evil people, evil megalomaniacs who are more evil than, you know, a common street criminal or whatever. Look, I mean, they're human beings. Sometimes they do make mistakes. They may be well-intentioned and make mistakes. They may be evil and creepy and know that what they're doing is harmful. But we're not making any bizarre radical claims that human nature is any different from what we all understand it to be, right? And of course, most people who will make throw these accusations around about, well, you guys believe in conspiracies or whatever, if you really ask that critic, they can come up with plenty of examples of where they think evil people were doing bad things through the government or whatever. You know, if it's someone on the left, you know, you talk to them about Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld, and they'll go on and on about these horrible, evil right-wing guys controlling the government and using it to further their objectives and those of their friends. But if you suggest that, well, maybe, you know, a Democratic administration might be viewed in that same light, they would call you a conspiracy nut. Right, so pointing out the inconsistency. And in fact, I mean, I think all of us would believe that our so-called revisionist perspective is simply common sense. It makes the best use of the historical data that we have. It uses reasonable theoretical arguments. It's the other view that government officials are saints, or that the government is always out to protect the public interest. That's the view that is crazy and nutty at worst.
One final comment. All research in the discipline of history is revisionist research. Why would a historian research a topic and write a book or an article if he had nothing to say that was different from the last person who wrote a book or an article on that topic? You have to revise the interpretation. What people do, including us who write on these topics, is we use our background in Austrian economics and public choice and these other disciplines that we're knowledgeable about, and that's the lens through which we look at these historical incidents. And so all historical research is revisionist history. And so, but you're right, the people who use this word, they want to make you think that you're like a Holocaust denier, that kind of revisionist history. And but and I'd say those people are not worth debating. You know, walk away, go debate somebody else, because they're not being honest.
Okay. Thank you, everybody. We're done.